pricing is a controversial subject at best for most equestrians. There are a ton of problems from gambling to drug abuse to high death tolls that plague the sport. But everybody loves an off-the-track thoroughbred, and in our rightful search for a more horse-friendly world, racing needs to be analyzed very carefully. Does it need to be thrown out altogether? Or are there ethical and practical shifts that we can take to make this billion-dollar industry one that prioritizes horses first? I'm your host, Laurel, and today I'm sitting down with Shelby Dennis of Milestone Equestrian to discuss just that. Shelby is a positive reinforcement Lima-based trainer and certified equine behavior consultant, and she has a lot of knowledge from her personal experience in the world of horse racing that she's been kind enough to share with us today. So, Shelby, welcome to the All Natural Horse Podcast. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you so much for inviting me on. I'm excited.
Yeah, me too. So you've shared your journey online for a number of years now, and that's included how you've changed your training practices from more traditional methods, right, to now positive reinforcement. And do you do that only right now?
I try to sway away from saying that it's the only thing I do, because like any trainer, even if they say they only do positive reinforcement, they're going to be using other quadrants at other times, even if it's accidentally. So I primarily use positive reinforcement, but it's very situational. Like if I have clients who aren't completely there yet and mostly use pressure and release, I'll try to cater to where they are in their training and just start to slowly, gently like coax them over to using more rewards-based methods.
That makes sense. Yeah, I like that that's more of a nuanced view of it. And now you are also a certified equine behavior consultant, right? Am I saying that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, through IAABC.
Okay. So that our listeners can sort of have an idea of your expertise, what does that mean, and what kind of does it take to become a certified behavior consultant?
So IAABC is one of the internationally leading behavioral institutes for all sorts of different animal behaviorists. Like they also do like dogs, cats, birds, and other stuff as well. And you have to go through a pretty extensive application process that includes having several references, including a veterinary reference and other professionals in the industry. And then it's recommended that you have a certain number of scholarly hours in post-secondary classes. And then it's an extensive application process where you have to demonstrate your knowledge of learning theory and equine behavioral science, and then also write a bunch of case studies, respond to scenarios that they write out for you with a full training plan and whatnot. So for me, I did that application process after doing probably like 6 full course credits through the University of Guelph's Equine Sciences program. And then also I've done a lot of my own field studies on my own and also under other equine behavioral professionals who I've gotten to work alongside and talk to and kind of pick their brains. So I've kind of had a mixture of like hands-on experience in the field in addition to working in a less structured like non-school environment with other people who have gone through all of these programs and more, and then also the schooling with Guelph before getting the behavioral certification.
Wow, that is a lot. How long did that take you?
The application, I think they gave me 90 days to do. Like I have ADHD, so I did like some of it initially, and then I finished most of it in like the last week of the application. So it was pretty time consuming, but like the case studies are long. So it was a lot of work. It was a big undertaking. I'm glad it's done now.
Yeah. and you were an exercise rider for racehorses for a number of years, right? Do you still do that?
Yeah, no, I don't do it anymore. I think the last time I did was in like 2021 or so. Yeah, I think 2021.
Mm. Okay, so you're sort of in a unique position to speak on the issues surrounding racing, and you have probably a lot more insight into it than the average person. So I'm interested to hear how your experience as a behavior consultant is going to provide some retroactive insight into that experience that you had as an exercise rider, you know, as well as just racing in general.
Yeah, I think that my approach is different than what a lot, like, people outside of the industry, it's a lot easier to, like, fault everyone. Like, what I noticed the most with racing in specific is that, unlike the competitive show industry, you're way more likely to have people who just go, everyone in this industry is a horrible abuser who doesn't like horses. Whereas if you did that about, like, show jumpers or something, people wouldn't let it fly because they'd be like, that is cruel to label everyone that way. So, like, I've gotten to know a lot of people in the racing industry in depth and see like how their brains work and how they perceive what they're doing, in addition to being able to just look at how the horses are actually handled and how the experience is for the horses. So I like to think that I have like a more compassionate approach than what some people might. And I think my biggest bone to pick with the view of horse racing in general is that it tends to be one that's viewed through the lens of like, this is so much worse than any other horse discipline. Let's target this one and deflect from our own disciplines. When really what I've noticed is basically the exact same problems are layered into every single competitive discipline ever where there's any money to be made. There's a lot of similarities and crossover. There's just certain issues that are more prevalent than others depending on the sport. So I think it's a human issue.
Yeah, I mean, that totally makes sense. And I once heard someone say that everyone's actions make sense to them, and no one's going to do something that they think is abusive to their horse in, by and large. And yeah, I think we are sort of blind to the things that we like and the problems that can exist there. So, as we're talking about racing, by no means for our listeners am I saying that every other discipline is perfect and that racing is the only one with issues. But I personally take a bit of issue when people relate racing to something like Big Lick. I just don't see much comparison there. You know what I mean?
No, I don't think they both have extensive problems and corruption, but I really don't think like Big Lick is so much less regulated than racing. Like racing has a ton of problems, but at the bare minimum, we are very fortunate that they have the injury database and that all of the horses' works are regulated and there's so much publicly available published information to track horses' careers and like get a pretty good idea of what might have contributed to the problems that they end up having and like who they were with at any given time. Like there's just solely off of the amount of documented information on racehorses, there's a lot more accountability and you stand a better chance of like figuring out when a horse went missing, where they might be, if they just kind of drop off the map and whatnot. Plus, the injury database allows for more accountability, especially as we go forward and push for better welfare regulations because it gives us a lot of documented information to research what the common denominators are for injuries and breakdowns and whatnot. So, yeah, I don't think it's compared. Like, I think the only real comparison that is there is that it's like, yeah, they both have problems and the horses suffer in both of them to a large extent. And that's really all I would see because the problems, as far as I'm concerned, are quite different, other than maybe how much the horses spend in stalls.
Yeah, I mean that totally makes sense. Yeah. Yeah, I don't see the big like you almost have to abuse a horse in order to do it, and that just doesn't seem to be the case in racing. Maybe the management is not ideal, but yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'd say Big Lick at the at its core, you're changing the natural gait of the horse to such an extent that like you have to do a lot of human-centered like the pads, the weights on the feet, like even just the hoof angles without even factoring in how much the stacks actually weigh, just the angle that the hoof has to be at. It's altering the horse's biomechanics in such a way that I don't think you can manage that without causing damage. Whereas like running itself is a really natural gait for a horse. And there's ways that we could do it in a way less damaging way than what is currently being done by so many people. Whereas Big Lick, I think in order to fix a lot of the problems it has, you'd have to take away the nature of the sport.
Yeah. So how did you get started as an exercise rider?
So I started working with off-the-track thoroughbreds that had like retired from racing, and that really piqued my interest about working with them on the racetrack. And I saw a job posting where a racehorse trainer was looking for a groom. So I messaged them and asked if they were looking for exercise riders, and they said they were, but they only wanted to take people with experience because they didn't want to go through the trouble of like training people. So then I ended up finding another trainer that was willing to train me, but then he L and broke his femur or something, like, oh, pretty early on into training me. So then at that point, I kind of did a U-turn and went back to the trainer that I initially messaged, because I found out that she worked with a lady that my mom knew quite well from high school. So then I got a reference from that lady, and then I ended up getting my in with that trainer, who essentially competed my training. And then I got thrown into the deep end about a month and a half into galloping when the other exercise rider quit, and I had to take on all of the horses. And then from there, it kind of, like, yeah, snowballed into a way bigger job than what I was initially intending. So I got to ride a lot of different horses and get a lot of experience, and I think it really helped with my understanding of how to train off the track thoroughbreds and just what they actually learn at the track versus what they don't. Because I find there's a lot of misconceptions that people will spread about off the track thoroughbreds with, like, how they're trained and why they behave the way that they do, and it's just, like, fundamentally not true. So being with them on the racetrack taught me how much of what I had learned about off the track thoroughbreds was actually just people kind of making their own stuff up after having had no experience with racehorses. So that was really helpful. I think that for the first while of me galloping, I honestly was quite sheltered from life at the racetrack because I was working at the farm. And the trainer that I worked with did things quite a bit differently than a lot of people do. So she kept a lot of her racehorses at the farm, and then they'd get hauled into town to go race. But then right after they'd race, they'd come back. So she was constantly rotating them off of the track in town so that they could come back to the farm and get turnout and live a more relaxing life. So what I noticed with her horses is they had substantially less stall vices and stress behaviors than other horses. And the ones that she did have that would crib or weave and do stuff like that were ones that she'd gotten from other trainers or who had come from other backgrounds. So it was a good lesson because I got to see firsthand how much her style of training actually made a difference, even if it wasn't necessarily perfect. And there's always room for improvements, but it kind of sheltered me from how other people handle their racehorses. And then a few years into galloping, my trainer that I was working with started the process of, like, going into her retirement. And then I did start outsourcing and galloping for other people in town. And that was kind of where I seriously pulled back from wanting to gallop and stopped doing it as much, because it was really not the greatest environment for me mentally, both because of the horses and also the people, because there's a lot of human problems there as well. So I'm really grateful that I had that first trainer as my influence in racing. Otherwise, I think my perspective of the industry as a whole would be way more negative than it is. But I saw how much people like her care and how the way that they do things and their open-mindedness does make a difference. So that was very beneficial.
Any of these topics are interesting to you, and you're the kind of person who just loves learning everything they can about horses and is obsessed with your relationship with your horse, go ahead and check out our free ebook at ahleri.com. That's ahleri.com. After this episode ends, to download our ebook titled Developing a Deep Friendship with Your Horse. In this ebook, we discuss the many common struggles that horse owners face when it comes to bonding with their horse and how you can get your fairy tale dream relationship with your faithful equine companion. I do think that that's something that people, like we were saying earlier, mislabel racehorse owners as, because they really do care about their horses and they want the best for them. But life on the track can be difficult to provide that, right? Can you tell me about sort of what the life of a racehorse looks like right now, from maybe their time that they're born to when they go to training to their time on the track?
Yeah, so I'm going to speak just for, like, North America, because it is quite a bit different in Europe and Australia, where they tend to haul their horses into the racetracks so the horses get to live at home more. They don't live at the tracks. But for horses that are living at the racetrack, they are stalled, like, at the vast majority of tracks. There might be some that have some type of turnout paddock, but they're going to be stalled for, like, 24 hours other than when they're either training or being walked or being bathed or doing something where they're being brought out of the stall for whatever reason, which is probably not going to encompass more than about an hour a day, if that, because when they're training, it's usually like 15 to 20 minutes. So, and then they walk after. So yeah, maybe like a total of like half an hour, 45 minutes maximum between the training and walking and whatnot. So I think one of the most prevalent issues for the horses welfare wise is the stalling, and I do have my own theories that I think it contributes more than people would think to breakdowns, because taking a horse from standing still for that long to running at a breakneck pace and having that kind of be their consistent life, like their muscles are going to be sore and they're not getting as much circulation throughout their body because they're just spending so much time standing still, and that's without factoring in like the ulcers and the how expensive chronic stress is in the body. As for like their lives growing up, I would say racehorses are really lucky from the standpoint of as babies. Like, they're usually, in most cases, like at most of the breeding farms I've been to, they're born and then they go out in like big herds with their moms and other babies, and they're just like turned out basically full time and just get to live outside and be out on usually big plots of land just running around and having a great time. Where it can get stressful is if they go through the yearling sale, because for yearling sale prep, they do, I don't know why they do this, like I think it's just for appearances because then the shoes get pulled right after, but they shoe them at like less than a year old in a lot of cases, or like just maybe just over a year old depending on when the horse is born, because they shoe them for the sale. And sale prep can be stressful because if they're not handled a ton while they're turned out, then they're getting brought out and they're getting handled and messed with a bunch in a fairly short span of time to prep for the sale. And then they get hauled to the sale and they're going in front of like a crowd in like an auction type setting that can be very stressful for them when they've had limited experience doing so. And like some barns are going to prep them better than others. So this isn't to say that everyone just tosses them into the deep end. But this is going to be like one of their first actual experiences of a job if they go through the sale, that is. And then once they're through the sale, like people typically pull the shoes and turn them back out. Like the vast majority of horses that I rode, like even when they were babies starting their training season, the two-year-olds were all barefoot until they had to go into the track. But I'm pretty sure that they have to be shod in order to be at the racetrack in town. So that's a whole nother issue, because like the shoes thing and track farriery is a pretty big problem at the racetrack that I also think contributes an awful lot to breakdowns. And then from there, like a lot of people will start their babies under saddle like in like January or December before the year that they're going to race. And like by start, I mean, like saddle the ones that do it well, saddle them, they'll ground drive them a lot, and they do a lot of the work from the ground, and then they will get people that like back them, usually really small light people, and then kind of just like make sure that they can steer, that they're not going to bronc when someone's on them, and that they know very basic cues, and then they get tossed back out. And this is also a Canadian specific thing too, because like our weather makes it so that some people might start it earlier when they have access to like indoor arenas or don't have frozen ground. So then they get tossed out and they might come back into work like around February or early March, and then that's where they're going to be started out like going onto the actual racetrack. Since the trainer I worked for had a track at her place, like all of the babies stayed at her farm until like April or May, and then they'd start going into town to do like gate schooling and getting used to being at the track in town, but they mostly stayed at her place to really learn how to go around the track. So they do get started really young. The one thing I would say that, like, I think with the starting two-year-olds aspect is it's very, very similar to how I see a lot of quarter horse trainers starting their horses, but the difference is that the race horses are ridden for way less time with way lighter tack and way lighter riders. So it's the speed that they're asked for is definitely more, but it's a little bit different. And the only reason I'm mentioning that caveat is because I find that a lot of the people in the Western discipline industries, there's a lot of people in those industries who are super anti-racing. And I think it's a bit hypocritical because we're comparing apples to oranges, where it's like, they're doing the exact same thing. The only difference is that there's more weight on the horses. And then they also do things like doing sliding stops on two-year-olds, which one of the things I learned at the racetrack is trainers freak out at you if you're on a baby and they stop suddenly when they're going fast. They lose their minds because it's really hard on their bodies and they're mad. And I personally think they need to bump the racing age to be older. I don't think that they need to be started that young. I don't think it's best for them. But from a business standpoint, I see why people don't want to, because it'd be way more expensive to wait. But I also think that they'd save money from the amount of wastage that they have of horses getting injured and stuff. So that's one of the bigger problems that I think people have. There are some studies that people will use to try to justify and be like, oh, horses who have more starts at two tend to have longer racing careers. And that is true that there are those studies, but from where I stand, there's way too many variables that could be contributing to why certain horses stay sound, and it might not actually be related to their age. And also, with that said, you can get all of the benefits of bone remodeling in a young horse without actually riding. So you could start doing slow work with a baby and like taking them for walks, or even like ponying them and exercising them like walk, trot, canter and stuff, but without packing weight of a rider and without going fast. So you could still get, like, it's not necessary to ride them. So I don't really agree with the people who try to use those studies to justify riding really young horses. And even for me doing it, like, I didn't agree with the fact that, like, two-year-olds were racing and stuff, and it made me uncomfortable. But I kind of looked at it from a more harm reduction standpoint. Like, if I quit my job right then and left, like, the babies would be getting ridden anyways. But a lot of the people who were at the track got more frustrated, and they'd be way more rough on them. And I'd also gotten to like handle a lot of these babies from the time they were born to the time that they were two. And I had developed a relationship with them. So the idea of having someone else go in there and potentially be really nasty to them, and also likely who weighs more than me because I'm a pretty small person, I didn't like that. So I didn't completely agree with the process, but I looked at it from the perspective of, I know I can do this process better than what other people will. So that's also one of the bigger problems. But for me, I think the problems that I need the most immediate change are like the turnout and the farriery at the track, because the hoof issues are horrendous.
Mm. Yeah, and I do agree on your point of, you know, how you mentioned that Western riders also tend to start their horses young. One other thing about it, though, is that race horses, they're going in straight lines, very gentle curves, doing very natural movements. Very, very hard work, no doubt. But they're not turning quickly. They're not doing small circles. They're not doing, like you said, sliding stops. So I guess it's hard to compare apples and oranges, but from a layman's perspective, who has no, you know, I don't have any skin in the game for either of these sports. From my perspective, it would seem that racing is almost more natural than something like cutting or reining with young horses.
I think so too. And I think that the big difference between the two, which is why people think racing is more, is that since the horses are going so much faster, when something really bad does happen, it's happening right in the public in the middle of a race.
Right.
And it'll be catastrophic because of how fast they're going. Mm. Whereas in slower disciplines, a horse can injure itself really, really badly, and odds are they will still be able to walk out of the arena.
Mm.
And since it's none of that's tracked, if they just disappear from the show ring, the owner doesn't have to say anything. It's not going to be tracked that the horse injured itself in the show ring and be put into a database. So it's easier to hide it. So I think that the difference is that we're comparing like horses who are going slower and might get chronic and severe lamenesses that mean that they can't be ridden or that they have to retire really young, but it's not going to be as catastrophic as the racing. And I think that's the big difference that people have. And also, racing is such a gigantic industry that I think the other issue is just like the sheer volume of horses who get injured catastrophically in the public eye feels like a lot to people because of how often they see it. But that's without factoring in how publicized it is and how many horses there are. Like, I wish that all competitive show industries had to be as publicized as racing is, because people would get away with less. Like, the trainers at every single show discipline that we can think of, they wouldn't be able to get away with as freely engaging in abuse with absolutely no shame. And I mean, racehorse trainers do it too, and it's 100% a problem. But when you're under more of a microscope, your behavior changes accordingly. And I think it would be beneficial for all disciplines to kind of take a similar page out of racing's book from the standpoint of how publicized the databases and statistics are, and how filmed and highlighted their show days are, where the horses are racing and whatnot. Like, it's all publicized, and even for training, like, most racetracks you can show up on any day of the week where horses are training, and you can go watch. You can go watch their works, and you can see what people are doing actively in training. You can't just walk into any old training barn and do the same thing, and it means that you get to hide a lot of stuff.
Right.
So I think that that's also part of it. But no, I agree. Like, if I had a young horse that I had to, like, that, and, like, there, not that I would ever do this, but if it was like, you have to start this horse at 2 years old, pick what type of trainer you'd send it to and what type of program, I would send it to racing over, like, a Western program, because they're ridden for less time and it's straight lines and slow bends. And contrary to what a lot of people think about racehorses and how they're exercised, like, they're not galloping them flat out every time they're exercising. Mm. It's like loping them along, especially the babies. So that's also important. Like, I don't think a 2-year-old ever should be, like, worked where they're running really, really fast. And that's definitely something that they do. And I don't think any 2-year-old needs to be ridden either, but because of the nature of the sport right now, you basically are in a position where you kind of have to at least start your 2-year-olds and bring them to the track and, like, introduce them to that life. You can't break even. Like, you can't make money. You can't make a living. And I think that this is one of the really complex things that people don't realize, is that a lot of the people in racing were born into racing and have had families that have been involved in it a lot. And all of their skills are highly specific to that industry. And if they don't make it in that industry, and if they don't get work in that industry, and if they don't make a living in that industry, they don't really have any fallback plan that is easy to go to that'll help them provide for themselves in the way that they might be able to at the racetrack.
Mm.
So there is a lot of pressure. And, like, as someone who's been working as a professional, like, when I was starting out, it was kind of the same thing. Before you build reputation and trust and community and really establish yourself, like, people will do anything to kind of slight your name, especially if you turn them down and say, no, that's not ethical. So it is really hard. Like, there's a lot of coercive pressures, and financial pressure is a huge one, because if you need to feed your family and pay rent and stuff, even if deep down you know something's wrong, you're more likely to justify it if it's between that and getting evicted.
Mm.
It's a difficult topic.
Yeah. I think that what you mentioned about turnout is a really big thing for me, especially because my horse lives out 24/7, and I see only positives from that. Of course, I like to have a nuanced view. I know that some horses need stalls for whatever reason, but excess stalling 24 hours a day at the racetrack, that cannot be good in my mind. So can you talk about the ethical implications and kind of studies that exist around excess stalling and the effect that that has on racehorses?
Oh, yeah. Oh, happily. Most of the studies on excess stalling are done on racehorses, because that's, like, the most prevalent industry where you see it to the volume that it is. And, like, just from my experience, like, I'll mention the studies too, but my experience anecdotally absolutely mirrors all of these studies, if not proves them to be even more of a problem than what the studies claim. Like, I have never seen more stall vices and stress behaviors in the stall than I have at the racetrack.
Mm.
And if you go and walk through the shed rows at any racetrack in the backstretch, and just go walk down the shed rows, don't even interact with the horses, and just watch how many horses are engaging in stress behaviors in their stalls, it's a huge portion of them. Like, the ones that don't end up developing stress behaviors, it's not because they're not stressed, it's because they're more resilient, or they found some type of outlet or their chronic stress that isn't directly related to being stalled. But honestly, like, most of them end up having some type of weird vice in their stall, whether or not it's, like, a popular one, like weaving, stall locking, wood chewing, or cribbing. They usually have something,
mm-hmm.
something that's a little off or weird about them, even if you only see it at feed time. And the studies on stall vices are honestly really sad, because, like, it's so clear, the studies, and this is one of the things that I find so frustrating about the stalling debate in specific, is that the amount of research and study that we have showing the problem is very, very clear. There is no denying the validity of it. It has been extensively proven how damaging being isolated and put in a small box is for a flight animal. There's no way around it. That's just the simple truth, whether people like it or not. And I find a lot of people who keep their horses in these types of environments are so desperate to justify what they're doing that they are willing to ignore all of this really, like, this huge wealth of research that shows the issues when really, like, there's not really any study out there, or, like, if there is, they're very, like, a very small number that shows any real benefit to excessive stalling like that. Like, there, and that's kind of also the lens that I look at through it from. If there's a ton of evidence of harm being caused, but no evidence of any real benefit at all, then it's like, why are we doing this the way that we're doing? So, for me, from a welfare perspective, I think the stalling is one of the worst things that happens to the racehorses. And don't get me wrong, the breakdowns and the injuries and how some trainers just pawn off their injured horses and, like, the level of wastage of horses who don't make it at the track and all that stuff, it's really terrible. But, like, the vast majority of their life is comprised of just standing in that stall.
Mm.
And on top of that, they're surrounded by all of these other horses who are riddled with stress. And if any person who's a highly sensitive person has been in a room full of stressful people, you don't have to be touching them or even looking at them to feel the waves of stress rippling off of them. And I guarantee you, horses can feel the same thing. It's a stressful environment. Most of their life, they're spending standing at a wall. And then they come out and they're really, really dangerous and difficult to handle. And no, it's not because they're a race fit racehorse who's getting fed a bunch of grain. It's because they don't get turned out. Like, all of these horses, if they were turned out while they were racing, they'd be way safer to handle. We'd probably see way less injuries to people and also injuries to horses. The one thing that racing does that I think is good compared to other types of boarding facilities is that the vast majority of racehorse trainers will always have hay in front of their horses. And that's one thing that I'll give to them that helps to some extent mitigate the damage that stalling does. But even with hay in front of them 24/7, these horses are still developing all of these problems. And another study on racehorses that's, like, one of the, like, more common issues that has been studied on racehorses in specific is stomach ulcers. And, like, racehorses have up to a 90% occurrence of stomach ulcers.
Wow.
And that can be contributed to due to lack of hay, or it can be due to stress, and it can also be contributed to a high starch diet. So racehorses have a really high starch diet and also a lot of stress. A lot of the racehorse trainers do have hay in front of them all the time, and they feed a lot of alfalfa. I'm inclined to believe that a lot of it's probably contributed to by the starch and the chronic stress. But a 90% occurrence of something that is so highly correlated with stress should be another sign that there's something very, very wrong going on. And it's not that other industries aren't guilty of that either, because there's like a 60 to 90% occurrence of ulcers across all types of performance horses.
Right.
So it's a very, very prevalent problem in the industry as a whole. But for me, the stalling is one of the things that bothers me the most about the racetrack, because it's what I had the hardest time with seeing. And then also a lot of the problems with riding the racehorses where people are mean to them and get frustrated or use really punishing and harsh training tactics. And even stuff like where they're getting their mouths yanked on because they're running through the bit. And, like, racehorses can be so strong and they will bolt on you. And if they bolt, they're just running blindly because they're so stressed and, like, chronically understimulated that they're not even really thinking if they get to that level of stress. So then people are pulling really hard on them to try to slow them down for their own safety. Because, like, if you ever had a racehorse get away from you, scariest thing ever. I would rather have a horse flip over on me than bolt on me if it's a thoroughbred racehorse. Like, full stop, way rather that. But a lot of the behaviors that they deal with riding are directly contributed to by being stalled too much. There's a lot of things that could be prevented, because if you're trying to, like, hold back a stressed horse who's trying to run through your hands the entire time, or is just, like, their muscles are, like, concrete that they're so stressed and they're leaping and screwing around on the racetrack, those things contribute to injury too. Mm. If you have a relaxed horse who's actually in their thinking brain and is, like, stretching and supple, they're going to be using their bodies in a way that's more protective by default, rather than putting so much energy into trying to escape whatever negative emotions that they're feeling. So the stalling, I think, is a gigantic, massive problem in the racing industry. And honestly, like, I'm at the point now where it's like, across any industry in horses, I do not think it should be legal at all under any circumstances other than ones, or if there's like an emergency response or something, an emergency situation. I don't think it should be legal to keep any horse isolated and stalled 24/7, because they're a social herd animal. There's no reason to do that to a healthy horse or during times where you're not in emergent situations.
And tracks are such big, I mean, they're massive. I personally I see no reason why they can't, other than just aesthetic problems, use the center of the track, make a few paddocks, even for individual turnout, and have that be more of a norm.
Oh, for sure. And they could. Like, I think the biggest thing is that they'd have to, like, yeah, reconfigure the tracks. I think they wouldn't want to use the center of the track because the horses would, like, freak out, which is kind of fair, but also the reason why they're freaking out is because they don't get outside. Like, if you actually provided them with that, like, the problem would solve itself. So all the problems that people are afraid of with turning their horses out because they're worried about them getting hurt or whatever, they're only there because the horses don't get out in the first place. But I think that they should just make all the stalls have in and out paddocks and just reconfigure the barns and kind of do it. Because right now they usually have, like, alleyways and shed rows. But if you essentially made a courtyard in the middle of each barn rather than having it be these laneways of stalls all in the same place and put in and out paddocks and just reconfigure the tracks, like, there is space for it. At the vast majority of tracks I've been to, there's space for it. They just use a lot of the extra space to create pretty gardens for people and, like, fountains and monuments and viewing stands and all that type of stuff. And it's, like, stuff that that's for the people who are attending the racetrack rather than the horses themselves. So, like, the space is there. And I do understand that, like, initially introducing these horses to turnout would be, like, a challenge to do, but it's not something that is, like, an insurmountable obstacle. Like, you could get professional help to help these horses adjust to that type of lifestyle without having there be as high of a risk of injury, and it would end up helping people a lot long term and avoiding a lot of problems that are currently there.
Yeah, I mean, even just, like, if it was an in and out thing, like you were saying, even just doubling the size of the amount of space they have every day until they are at the maximum, something like that. I mean, it seems so doable, and there's so much money at these racetracks that it's almost like, why aren't they solving this issue? Because I agree, like, I mean, you see, so with the stable vices thing, like, you see the same thing in, like, fur farms of foxes just spinning circles in their cages, and at some zoos of the animals just weaving back and forth. You see that, and you know that that's not natural and that's not right. Is there sort of a thing at the racetrack where if 90% of the horses are doing some kind of stereotypic behavior, is it sort of a thing of, like, this is just what horses do and that's kind of the way you view horses in general?
Yeah. Yeah, people will go, oh, they're just a racehorse. Oh, they're feeling racy. Like, she's ready to race, and, like, It's so, like, I think that's the problem, is, like, you're kind of in an echo chamber, especially if you don't do any riding or anything outside of racing. Like, you're surrounded by all of these horses who are doing these same types of things, so it starts to feel normal, and people will make excuses for it. And I think also part of it is, even if a part of them knows that it's weird and that it seems like a stress behavior, since they have to be surrounded by it every day, I think they lie to themselves to keep themselves sane, because accepting the reality would make it a lot harder to happily do their jobs and not feel bad for the horses. Because it's not like a lot of the people at the track don't watch, like, movies like Blackfish, for example, and go, wow, that's so terrible, those poor whales. And there's just such a disconnect because they can't seem to see the similarities between the animals they work with and the stuff that they criticize in other industries. And yeah, I think that people feel like it's normal just because they see it so often, and the behaviors are just so rampant that you're like, oh, like, all racehorses do this, which is, like, I mean, it's true. Like, a lot of them do those behaviors, but it's not because they're racehorses. It's because they all have this collective shared trauma that is resulting in these stress behaviors.
Yeah, cognitive dissonance is something that's so easy to slip into because nobody wants to think that the thing that they're doing is wrong. So that totally makes sense to me. Something recently that I've been really interested in is the idea of free choice and consent in movement, right? So you can put a horse on a walker, you can ride him around, you can even take him on a walk for 12 hours a day, and he'd be getting plenty of exercise like he would be in turnout. But the difference is that it's on the human's terms, right? And he can't run, he can't change directions, he can't stop when he wants to, he can't go run and buck. Is there any research behind freedom of movement for horses and choice in that, and the effect that restricting that can have on their psychology?
So they've done some studies, like, on how horses respond to, like, being ridden and, like, just other types of coercive training methods where it's like, okay, like, responding to, like, tight nose bends and bits and like other coercive and forceful means that people use to get them to do stuff. And there's very clear indicators of stress, whereas turnout is shown to reduce stress. So while it might, like, the studies might not specifically be related to autonomous choice in all of those, there's clear indicators that not having the choice to make decisions in ridden settings or in their stalls damages welfare, and having the ability to have free choice and autonomy improves it. And there has been some studies on stalling in particular that talk about like the lack of autonomy and how horses will want to go outside, and that's why you see behaviors like weaving develop, but then they can't. And the lack of ability to kind of feed that urge is very stressful to them, and it results in them developing a stress behavior. So I think that's something that people need to be more conscious of, is it's not like the issue with like turnout versus stalling is not the exercise itself. It's the being able to have recreational activity that the horse gets the complete choice to do. Because yeah, you could go and work the crap out of your horse and physically exhaust them, but it's doing nothing for them mentally. It's exhausting their physical body and I guess making them tired enough that they are quieter in their stall maybe, but it's not enriching them mentally or feeding their species specific needs. Because if you watch horses in a natural setting, especially when they actually have free access to being outside, like they don't go running around and careening around and working themselves to the point that the average rider will ask them to during a ridden session. They'll have short bursts of activity, and then even when they're playing, it'll be like a burst of activity, and then there'll be some breaks, and then another burst of activity, and then some breaks. But overall, for their daily time budget, it comprises very little of the time spent. Most of their time is spent like meandering around, picking at grass, eating, sleeping, mutual grooming. But the overwhelming amount of time spent eating. So it's not like the turnout versus stalling issue is not one of exercise, and you can never make up for turnout by using manufactured exercise. Or even like I've seen people talk about, oh, I turn them out in the arena and they get to go run around, and it's like, okay, like that's better than nothing, I guess, because they're getting to burn off all of this pent up energy. But it's being done in a stressful way. It's being done because they have pent up energy in the first place that has resulted in needing to expel all this pent up stress. And it's not being done in a way that is like enriching and enjoyable to them. Like even in that case, like technically they have autonomy because they're running around and they're not being controlled by a person. But it's through the lens of them expelling stressful energy that has built up because they haven't been out. It's not enriching their life long term in the way that it should be.
I like what you said about that, because a lot of people will say, well, I turn my horse out for 6 hours and all he does is stand there in the middle of the field. But the thing about it is he has the choice to do that, and if he doesn't want to do that, he doesn't have to.
But also, when people say that, most of them board their horses, and it's like you're only at the barn for like an hour or so a day, maybe 2 hours. I'll even be generous and I'll give them 3 or 4 hours a day. You're not there for the other 20 hours. You don't know what they're doing for the vast majority of their time in turnout. And let's say even they spend most of their time just standing there. How much enrichment is there in the field? Do they have friends? Do they have different hay stations to walk to? Is there any incentive for them to go do anything? And like these are the things. If the horse really is just standing there listlessly doing nothing and that's all they actually do, a lot of times it's because their turnout area lacks enrichment and there's not really anything for them to do because they're just standing in like a crusher dust square with no other friends. So I think that's the important part that people kind of need to start looking at it through that lens, where it's like, one, the vast majority of people don't see their horses very much. Like, I literally live on the same property with my horses, and I'll readily admit, like, I'm only seeing them for, like, a few hours each day collectively. And they live on the same property as me, and I can go walk down there at any time and go look at them, but I'm not, like, sleeping in their pen with them. However, being able to, like, walk at any time of day, it does give you a good idea of what they do at different times of day, because they tend to have ritualistic behaviors where they do different types of things. And you start to learn what they do when and why. And yeah, so like I think that's something that anyone needs to consider, is if you board your horse, or even if they live at home and you're only seeing them for a few hours a day, you're not actually getting the full scope of what they're doing. Like, it'd be one of those situations where if you're allowed to, you could put a camera up in your stall and then start watching the recordings back at all hours of the day to get a really good idea of like what their day actually looks like, and it would probably make people feel quite sad.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're only viewing a few hours of the horse's entire life, and you have no idea what happens the rest of the time. That's totally true. Before we get any further, I just want to ask our listeners, if you're enjoying the episode so far and want it to reach other equestrians, please take the time to go ahead and just leave a review. I know every podcast asks for reviews, but it really does help us out probably way more than you would think. So please, if you're enjoying it, go ahead and take a quick moment, leave a review on whatever podcast platform you're using, and let us know what you think. It would really mean a lot. I really wanted to talk about winning and the horse's perception of winning. A lot of people will say that racehorses specifically, they win because they want to. And some people say it about jumpers, but mostly racehorses. They understand that they were the fastest horse. They beat out all their competitors and they want to be first. And people will use this argument to justify racing and justify a lot of the things that happen on the racetrack. So can horses understand the concept of winning?
No, not from a lens where they're like, I am the champion. I would say here's what they might understand. The horse who's is ahead and being really fast and ahead of all the other horses is going to get whipped less. So they learn that that's the most effective place to be, and that's kind of what they've been conditioned to do, generally speaking, through coercive forces, because very few people in the racing industry use rewards-based training. And same thing with the jumper. They learn, hey, if I don't take any rails and I go fast, my rider stays out of my mouth more, doesn't use the spurs and the whip as much, and I get petted and I might get more treats, and my rider's general emotional state feels more favorable in certain settings than others. And the same can be said about racehorses, where they've learned through repetitive routine scenarios that being ahead of all the other horses is the most favorable place to be, not because they necessarily want to be there because they like it, but because they get essentially harassed less by their riders. They're not getting whipped, or even if the rider chooses not to use the whip, the rider's not going to be as busy and loud on them to try to get them to move ahead if they're already winning and they're not like in close quarters to another horse. So they will never understand the concept of winning in the way people do, because it would require them to not only understand that the entire purpose of the race is to be ahead and to win, but to also understand that it is a competition and that they are being judged on how quickly they finish it, and that there is some type of status involved for the win of it. And they just do not have the ability to comprehend that. It's a very human-centric idea. So every type of thing that we see in horses where we're like, oh, they know they've won, it's going to be a conditioning thing where they've learned through our behavior that outcome is the most favorable for them. And it's probably because we change the way we treat them, or even like our general attitude and demeanor shifts so that the horse is like, wow, this is the better decision. I get bothered less when this happens. I get rewarded more when this happens. And that sort of thing. They do not under any circumstances have the capacity to look at human society and understand how we have structured sports and how we determine winners and value and good little horses. They don't get that.
Yeah, I mean, that makes total sense to me. Yeah, the use of whips, like you said, it's a big thing in racing. And a lot of the times it seems like they're used really harshly. Like if it was used that harshly in, say, the jumpers, you'd be disqualified. So can you talk about whipping in the racehorse industry and the effect that excess whipping can have on a racehorse? You know, because a lot of people will say, oh, you know, they have thicker skin, it doesn't hurt them. But more and more studies are showing, A, it does hurt them, and B, it might not even be necessary to whip them to get them to go faster, right?
Yeah, no, and I don't think it does, because like by the time they hit the final stretch, it's like they are tired, and like that's why they're slowing down, and like hitting them doesn't make them less tired. So I think it's kind of like it like that, the saying beating a dead horse, it's kind of like that, where you're flogging a tired horse. And like you might be able to spike their adrenaline enough to get a little bit of speed, but I don't think there's enough evidence that whipping actually helps. It's not increasing motivation. And also if it does, it's increasing motivation because the horse is running away from the discomfort of the whip. Also, horses' skin is actually thinner than ours, so the thick skin argument is completely false. I don't think whipping increases speed. I think in terms of increasing speed and motivation, people could provide more incentive for the horses to actually want to finish first, rather than making it so that they're effectively running away from discomfort in order to cross the finish line. Like, you know how they train, like, greyhound race dogs where they're following, like, that toy?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think you could train race horses in a similar way where you could target train them over a long span of time and they learn through slow approximations where they'd be, like, walking after it initially, but that they get rewarded really heavily for following the rail of the track and crossing the finish line. And then you could probably teach them to run and do that themselves. Like, you'd even start it as babies. If you started using the start bell to buzz them and tell them, hey, it's dinner time, and they come running in from the field, you've already started effectively conditioning that behavior.
They probably wouldn't even need a rider then.
Well, exactly. And that's the other thing, is for like 2-year-olds, if they wanted to race them and they could do it without riders, that would be objectively better for them because it would be less wear and tear. Still probably isn't great for them to repeatedly be running that hard on baby legs, but it would be better than packing a rider.
That's really interesting, yeah, because that does seem like it would reduce injury, just having less weight overall on their backs. Thanks so much for listening into this episode. I really hope you enjoyed it and that you learned something. If you'd like to go ahead and learn more about Ollery and what we do and the products we make, I recommend checking out our Instagram. It's Ollery Equine Products, A-H-L-E-R-I, Equine Products on Instagram. You can also visit our website, Ollery, A-H-L-E-R-I.com. And there you can find our Muzzled Butter at Ease Scent Stick, which is our science-backed, non-invasive, essential oils-based calming aid that applies right to their horse's nose that we developed to help horse owners take the first step towards prioritizing their horse's mental health just as much as they prioritize their horse's physical health. Join us next Wednesday on the All Natural Horse Podcast as we continue this discussion with Shelby on ethical horse racing. Until next time, see you guys later.